think it often leads you into fooling yourself that you're doing a service to the subject. We're taught in journalism school that, I mean, if you want to make it, if you want to put it in crude terms, that there are always two sides to every story and that you should just, you should show both sides. And of course, I think you need to show different versions of a story or give different ideas, but the fact that there are two sides to every story doesn't necessarily mean that one they're both equally right or they're both equally wrong. I've heard journalists say things like, well, I've pissed everyone off, I must be doing something right. I never really think in those terms. I mean, I think you should strive for what is the truth of the situation. And that's what I'm going for. I mean, I have my own prejudices going in. I want people to know that I am an imperfect journalist going into a place, but also I choose my subjects because I have a sympathy for them. I'm interested in what the Dene people have to say about resource extraction and their own lives. I don't want to balance that with what resource extraction industry is saying about what they're doing and what the Canadian government is saying about what they're doing. I want to maybe touch on it, but it's, I'm not trying to wash out one with the other.
Yeah.
So I have a point of view. It's signaled by the fact that I'm actually a figure in my drawings. You see that it's one person's, you're seeing a lot of things through my eyes. And I'm comfortable with my worldview. I'm comfortable with my subjectivity. And where I sort of had my real first, where objectivity sort of broke itself on the anvil of reality was, had to do with the Palestinian situation, because I grew up thinking Palestinians were terrorists, and I realized that was because of objective journalism that was telling me that this had happened, there'd been a hijacking, there'd been a terrorist attack, there'd been a commando raid, and those were all objective facts, but they didn't provide me with background, with other facts, or with any sort of holistic picture of what was actually going on. And through these sort of cherry-picked facts, I had a very skewed idea of a whole group of people. And that example has served me well throughout my entire career, where you have to separate what are facts from what is the truth of the situation, because facts can be ordered in any way to come up with any, you know, any sort of idea that you want.
Well, the first time we actually see you, Joe Sacco, in the book as a figure is fittingly in the second chapter, which sort of begins to introduce the encroachment of quote unquote Western influence on the region, and opens with you and your guide also going into the region. And this is also where it feels like the imagery shifts, where we start to see the frames or boxes that delineate scenes that people are most used to seeing in comics, whereas in the first chapter, there really are no divisions or borders. But as the book progresses, it becomes clear also why I think the first voice in the book is Paul Andrew, because his life straddles a divide between the life before a circle of meaning and a life after, which is a feels like a different set of circles or cycles of dependency, whether it's alcohol and drugs or welfare or physical and sexual abuse, and a world where every option seems to be a bad option to a greater or lesser degree. But so I wondered if perhaps the central exploration of the book is not your initial impulse to discuss resource extraction, but how this one circle is broken and this other set of circles is created. And I guess in that light, I was wondering if you could orient us to the scenario of residential schools and how they were the vanguard of cultural genocide in Canada, because it feels like in a way, at least as I walk through with you, it feels like that is one of the big things that you discover and then spend a lot of time unpacking in terms of the way it's reverberated into the present moment.
Well, that's what I meant when I said that I went up to do a book about resource extraction, and pretty soon it became a book about a lot of other things. But definitely the residential schools is something I'd read about beforehand, but it's only really when I was there that it became really how it became very clear to me that this wasn't just something that had happened to the Dene people or the Indigenous people of Canada. It was one of the primary things that happened to them, and it's something that, even though the residential school system is finished, is continuing to happen to them. And basically, from about the 1850s on up to about the 1990s, Indigenous people, Indigenous kids, were taken from their families and put into school systems which were not just meant to get people to read and write. That wasn't the point was to, and this was outlined very specifically by the first Prime Minister of Canada, the purpose was to break people from their culture. It was to turn Indigenous people into some form of a white person, to Christianize them, to eradicate their languages, to make them think and like white people, and ultimately be useful to white people as wage laborers. I mean, there's no other way to see what happened except through those terms. So I have a number of characters in the book which describe to me in some detail what happened to them. How, let's say in the case of Paul Andrew, a plane landed near the camp, and a RCMP, a Mountie basically, and a couple of other people came out and just took some of the kids with them and flew them off to who knows where, basically, because the parents did not know where their kids were going. Sometimes in these situations, siblings were split up. And these kids suffered horribly from this, of course. They were away from their parents, away from the land, and they were regimented. They were made into some, like I say, some version of white people. And it's had a tremendous impact on Indigenous people in Canada. When these kids eventually returned to their homes, they had been traumatized by all kinds of physical abuse, in many cases sexual abuse, and they often came back not really knowing how to speak their language anymore, not being able to speak to their grandparents, for example. And this was basically cut them off from their communities. And it's taken the people who've been successful at doing it, it's taken them a long time to reestablish those connections with their traditions, with their culture, with their language. But many people, as you can imagine, succumbed to things like alcohol. They were self-medicating. They were trying to sort of get through the day after being traumatized for years and years and years. And so this has not only affected the people who went through the residential school system, but it's affected the children of those people, because trauma is visited again on the next generation and then the next generation. And so you'll see the cycle of domestic abuse and alcoholism that has pervaded the Indigenous communities. And so what you've taken communities that were very, very strong, which I'm describing in the first chapter, had a great sense of themselves and where they belonged in the scheme of the cosmos, basically, in very profound ways, and you've cut them from that. And so the residential school system has pervaded every aspect of people's lives, how they deal with each other, how they deal with the Canadian government, how they approach land claims. It seemed to sort of infiltrate every bit of their lives, as I said.
Yeah. Well, this 150 year period of kidnapping children, forcing them to speak English and practice Christianity, and all the various sadistic things that happened in the schools, was ultimately called cultural genocide by the Canadian government itself as part of the of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I wondered if you could just touch on the both the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the payout that happened to the Indigenous peoples of Canada, and also your thoughts on that reckoning in relationship to the United States. Do you feel like Canada has had more of a reckoning than the United States? Do you feel like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is something that has moved things forward, if we can say forward, or at least been a step towards reparation?
Well, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was sort of an offshoot of a class action lawsuit brought against the government of Canada by survivors of the residential school system. So the payouts were something separate from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but were somehow also linked to that process. So the problem with the payouts, as was described to me by William Greenland, who works with Indigenous people on domestic abuse issues, is that a lot of people who testified before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission were redredging a lot of very terrible traumas, and they were giving testimony. In doing so, a lot of things that they had been trying to suppress with alcohol were coming back up. When they got payouts, he told me, some of them had a lot of money suddenly and basically just drank themselves to death. So there's that aspect of it. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I think, rightfully said that cultural genocide had been perpetrated on the Indigenous peoples of Canada. I think it was a very useful thing in that people were able to tell their stories, and it became very officially recognized as part of a record. And I think the Canadian government squirmed hearing those words by this independent commission, eventually has apologized. I think all those things are to the good. Obviously, in the United States, there's been no reckoning that I can see with what happened to Indigenous peoples here. So what they did in Canada is for the good, but is it, you know, there's a an Indigenous intellectual named Leanne Simpson, and she makes a point that whatever the Truth and Reconciliation did that was good in getting Canada to look at what had happened during the residential school period, it's also an official thing. Does everything sort of stop? Is everything sort of tied with a bow once this commission announces, okay, it's cultural genocide? Actually, the effects of the residential school system will continue, probably for generations. And so it's still unwinding. Like colonialism itself, it's still unwinding.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of communities, especially when there's a scarcity of representation, are wary of having their, let's say, quote unquote, dirty laundry aired to the world publicly. Like if there's a scarcity of representation of a group, often they just want to have their best face put forth to the public. And I wondered about in this project, I mean, we do see, you do frame it really well. I mean, you do frame that all of the things that are going on now, drinking to extended blackouts and premature death, astronomical suicide rates, sexual abuse within the community that is five times the national average, is all coming from this protracted trauma and from the residential schools and this complete and intended breakdown of intergenerational knowledge. But I did still wonder if there were parts of the community you encountered that didn't want these things, these struggles that are going on within the community now, to come out. Because it's one of the great things about the book is you have so many people who are speaking by name. Like, we know, we get to know people first and last name. Obviously they're willful participants, but you go to some very fraught and dark places with them around recovery and around reclamation of traditional skills, around bringing back language, but also around abuse that has been suffered or abuse that has been passed on from generation to another. Were there any sense of people you encountered that wanted to close ranks around that, the way you might see in so many other communities when you don't see a lot of people of that community in literature?
What I was told to be careful of was, I mean, someone actually told me, and it wasn't an Indigenous person, was don't bring up residential schools. Because that person was worried that it would create some sort of, you know, someone reliving their trauma in front of me, and that might not be a good thing. But the thing is, a lot of these things came up organically without me probing. Talk about alcoholism, talking about what people had suffered in residential schools. I never pushed people to tell me what they weren't going to tell me. Some people sometimes would say, I'll tell you this, you know, and of course you just respect that. I didn't probe in that way. But things like residential schools and alcoholism in particular were things that were always hovering in conversations. People would often mention that they'd been drinking and they stopped. It came up. And they told me about these things in pretty organic ways. Mm. So it's not, there might have been one case where I sat down with someone and said, I'd like to talk to you. No, a couple of cases where I said, I want to talk about residential schools. But those were cases where people told me what they wanted to tell me and no more. Alcoholism came up quite a bit. People are very aware that it's a problem in the Northwest Territories. It's no secret, in other words. I only obviously put in what people told me and what they seemed to be comfortable telling me at the time. The important thing for me, because if you see the structure of the book, I start talking about the problems before I really get into the reason why. I don't talk about what happened, the cruelties and the trauma of the residential schools, until I've already let people know that there's a big problem with alcohol and the community seem somehow adrift from all the things that had made them so strong before. It's important to show the context of these traumas and to really point the finger where it should be pointed. Because to me, when I see, or when people tell me about the alcoholism and other problems within the communities, it's about colonialism. I mean, to me, I see colonialism when people talk to me about alcoholism. There are things that did not exist before contact and certainly did not exist before the residential school system made people into, it basically tried to misshape people. So I really, what's important to me is to put it in the context and to show what the sort of damage colonialism can bring upon a people.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Joe Sacco about his latest book, Pain the Land. Well, let's pivot to resource extraction itself, the thing that originally brought you to this project, a desire both to do something on climate change, but obliquely, but also to do something that wasn't about war. In your manifesto at the beginning of journalism, one of the things you reject is the notion of fair and balanced, which you've talked a little bit about already today. And you quote the British journalist Robert Fisk, who said, "Reporters should be neutral and unbiased on the side of those who suffer." And to me, that seems clear in your work as an ethos, whether it be Bosnian Muslims or Palestinians or African migrants. You aren't on the side of the Israelis and the Palestinians, but on the side of the dispossessed, even as you try to portray the complex reasons and realities and contradictory narratives. But without knowing much one might imagine that Fisk's motto could also apply here, that you're on the side of the Diné against the forces of resource extraction. But as you've alluded to, the situation that you encounter is really different. You're clearly on the side of these indigenous communities, but it feels like to be on their side is to show a full spectrum of their relationship to resource extraction, which isn't usually one of clear opposition. So I was hoping maybe you could talk to us about more in more detail about what you discovered in, with regards to indigenous relationships to resource extraction in the Northwest Territories, and then how you go about, as you did with alcoholism, for instance, contextualizing this extremely complex relationship that's happening now.
I think the relationship that Indigenous people have in the Northwest Territories to resource extraction is related to what happened to them as colonialized people. They were basically forced off the land. If people didn't want to send their kids to residential schools, the only alternative was to have a school built in your community and move into the community. So people stopped living off the land. So what you have then is the vast majority of people in the communities I went to, the only jobs that are available, the people have been turned into wage laborers, basically. They used to survive off the land, now they're wage laborers. So the only jobs available are the extraction jobs. Those are the only real jobs available that actually pay relatively well. There are government job, there are government sector jobs, and there's welfare. Those are the alternatives. So people's relationship with resource extraction is quite realistic. For those people who their only employment is out in the oil and gas fields, they want those jobs. So they are much more interested in having the jobs and maybe trying to figure out a way that the impacts can be mitigated. I never met any indigenous person who didn't sort of qualify what they were telling me about resource extraction by saying, we have to take care of the land first. That's the most important thing. All of them said that. But then within that, some people were just opposed to it because they didn't like the idea of chemicals being injected into the land for fracking. And, you know, where are those chemicals going to come up and what are those chemicals? And other people just thinking, we need jobs here. How else are we going to survive? You know, they see the old ways are just no longer practicable. People have lost a lot of their bush skills. So there's a lot of there was one community I was in, Toledo, where there's quite a range of ideas about what resource extraction meant. And it wasn't just about the land, it's also what it means to a community. When you build a road to a community and make it very accessible so that resources can be extracted around it, if you're bringing in workers who aren't indigenous, you're bringing in trouble. You're bringing in alcohol. You're bringing in all kinds of things. You're raising the prices of, you know, in the hotels, the places that are being rented. There are issues that come with accepting resource extraction. So some people are opposed to that, and some people are opposed to just what the extraction is doing to the land. But like I say, it wasn't monolithic. There are a lot of people on different sides of that issue. There is also something that I've seen too, is sometimes between communities there can be problems. In the south of the Northwest Territories, I looked at two communities. One of them called Trout Lake at the time. Now it's called Sambaque, if I'm pronouncing that right. I hope I am. And the other one is Fort Liard. And they're both sitting on a substantial amount of natural gas. One community is very cautious about what that might mean to it if they open up for development. And the other community has been much more gung-ho under the chief they had at the time. So you'll find there are conflicts that develop between indigenous communities because if the boundary between those communities hasn't been settled, then it's going to be an issue.
Right.
So there's a lot. There are a lot more things going on when you're talking about resource extraction. It has to do with what people think about the land, what they think about development coming in, and then it has to do with, well, where's our boundary?
Well, it made me think of situations also that seemed similar in the United States, and some of the research that I had done for preparation with different indigenous poets who've come on the show, discovering that the relationship between the Navajo and coal mining, and that the Navajo have the third largest coal mining business in the United States. And, you know, there are people, obviously we know of the people, indigenous people blocking the pipelines, but also the indigenous people working on the pipelines. But also where you and I live, Joe, there are many tribal nations that are involved in timber and timber harvest. And they say something similar to what you heard over and over again in the Northwest Territories. It's better to control resource extraction than to have it control us. So in a way, it's like the different options on the table are different degrees or methodologies or limits around extraction, but non-extraction is not really one of the central options.
I'd say most people, even those who were quite felt themselves quite close to the land and to their traditions, didn't foreclose the idea entirely, resource extraction. But I did meet people who would like to get away from it, you know, totally. I think for me, the surprise was I thought there'd be much more opposition than I found. But then when you see the economic realities of the place and what are, you know, like you say, what are the options? I mean, welfare, is that an option? Maybe you could say it helps people and all that, but it also, it creates a cycle of dependency, right, that might not be healthy for people who were very strong in and of themselves beforehand. And government jobs, okay, that's one thing, but that's also a system that is quite bloated. And I mean, as they say in the Northwest Territories, we're the most governed people on earth. They have so many systems of overlapping government structures. There are so many government workers there. I won't say that's a form of welfare, but in some ways it begins to seem like it.
Well, I did appreciate how we see this full spectrum. Like, I'm thinking of Daryl Beaulieu.
Oh yeah, right.
Who's very pro fracking, and he's pro the idea that the community will succeed by creating more jobs, bringing more work to a community that has astronomical unemployment. And he says also, I think correctly, that the Diné are conflicted about resource extraction, but so is the world. And then he says to us, if you don't feel comfortable with extraction, stop using your car and your iPhone. But then there are people like Amos Scott, who's a younger generation, one that is trying to reconnect what has been lost culturally, who also says that even if the Diné do everything right by the land, even if they right themselves to the land, reestablishing a true reciprocity with the land, this notion of paying the land, where the caribou would be healthy again, where the Diné people consider themselves the caribou people, there would still be climate change because of what's going on everywhere else. And it would still affect them more than most people, which he said with a lot of obviously justified anger. I don't know. It feels like getting this full spectrum in a weird way. Amos Scott and Daryl, even though they have extremely different responses, one super pro industry and one reconnecting to lost traditional skills, they seem like they share, or at least partially share, the same analysis of the way they're trapped in this cycle.
both Daryl and Amos understand that they are in a wider context, a worldwide context, that the climate change situation isn't just a matter for indigenous people to solve and to block. They are caught up in capitalism like all of us are, and they have to feed themselves. And they understand this. Whether they want to go ahead with it and sort of roll with what capitalism is, sort of the cards that capitalism has played to them, or whether they are critiquing it like Amos is and recognizing it, but understanding that they are in that, that they're all, they are in that structure. They both understand that the ultimate, the paradigm we live in is capitalism.
Well, thank you for spending the time with me today, Joe.
It's a great pleasure, David.
We are talking today with Joe Sacco, the author of Paying the Land from Metropolitan Books. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.